From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, a special series from To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Tim Fleming. This hour, can science be sacred?
You have to have an open mind. I mean, you can't have a closed mind in science. You can't go around with your eyes closed and a pair of blinkers on you.
Most of the early great scientists, whether it's Max Planck, Niels Bohr, Erwin Schrödinger, Heisenberg, Einstein, they were thoughtful, reflective, could even say contemplative.
Does science have anything to offer those of us who want some experience of the sacred, who yearn for deeper meaning and more fulfilling lives, but have given up on organized religion? Today we'll explore the far corners of science as we search for the sacred.
I hear the whippoorwill cry. I see the blue heron fly over Sugar Hill, snowy white, big blue siren in the night. Come meet me, bed we go under a stormy sky.
First, we turn to a fascinating and growing movement among secular scientists and philosophers. They believe the natural world all around us is full of marvels and mysteries. These scientists typically don't believe in God, or at least any conventional notion of the divine, but they also don't like the label atheist. Some call themselves religious naturalists. In fact, they want a science-based spirituality. Steve Paulson has this report on what he calls the awe and wonder crowd.
Perhaps no living scientist has done as much as E.O. Wilson to explain why so many of us feel exhilarated when we're outdoors, immersed in the natural world. Wilson's a renowned biologist at Harvard who's won two Pulitzer Prizes for his science writing. He popularized the concept of biophilia, the notion that we're hardwired for powerful responses to the natural world. And he thinks this deep connection to nature can take on religious overtones. In fact, Wilson grew up a fundamentalist Southern Baptist, but he abandoned his faith once he learned the story of evolution. So I wondered, just what exactly does inspire awe and wonder in E.O. Wilson?
It certainly involves a sense of sublimity and a sense of the mightiness and the splendor and almost indecipherable intricacy of something greater than ourselves. It's not limited to religious revelation either. It appears there. A lot of mysticism of religion arises directly from it, but it's equally experienced by the secularist whose mind opens to the splendor and intricacy of the universe.
I've talked with some atheists who have suggested that what they really need is a spiritual atheism. They need this sense of awe. They're competing against the religious stories, the religious traditions that have been passed down over the eons with very emotionally powerful stories. Does the non-believer need that as well? Can the non-believer have that?
The answer to the second question is yes. The answer to the first question, do they have it, is usually no. The problem with secular humanism is that it does lack it.
Well, would you be comfortable in saying that science can have a sacred dimension?
Sacred, yes, in the sense of spirituality. Sacred in the sense of creation myth and of a belief of a personal, intrusive deity, no.
So what do you mean by spirituality?
The same sensation of grandeur, even of holiness. This would be, I think, based upon deeper and deeper understanding of just how intricate the universe is and how surprising. The story of the origin of life on this planet, the time scale, the magnitude of it, all of that together engenders in me probably even more awe than I ever felt as a devout young Southern Baptist growing up.
Ursula Goodenough is another secular scientist who marvels at the awe and wonder of nature. She's a leading cell biologist at Washington University and author of the book The Sacred Depths of Nature. But her appreciation of the natural world didn't come easily. Around the age of 20, Goodenough was shaken by a kind of existential panic after taking a physics class. During a camping trip, she looked up at the night sky. and suddenly felt overwhelmed by the pointlessness of it all.
I suddenly realized that I was no longer thinking of our place as being this cute little planet with a sky over it, that the whole thing was huge and immense and that the sun was going to go out. And I got very, very upset and disoriented and fearful, terrified, actually.
That terror stayed with Goodenough for a long time. Finally, she realized what the problem was, her compulsion to find some ultimate purpose to the universe and to her own life. She then found a way to work through her anxiety.
Why there is anything at all, why the universe is here, why I'm here, is a mystery. Once I did that, then I was in a place where I could just take the whole story and take quarks and electrons and galaxies and everything and just say, okay, this is the way it is. Don't know why, but wow, it's pretty amazing. And lucky me to be a part of it.
So you're saying this kind of scientific understanding for you, I mean, the more that you really get into the way life evolved, where the Earth came from, all of that, that really evokes for you profound feelings of awe and wonder.
You bet. I can't think of anything that even comes close.
What's so striking about this movement among scientists to find or even create a spirituality without God is that it spans so many different disciplines, from biology to neuroscience to physics. Take Joel Primack, a cosmologist at UC Santa Cruz and co-author of the book The View from the Center of the Universe. He's out to show that we humans are not just an insignificant speck in the cosmos. Primack believes we're special in various ways. For instance, our size is right smack in the middle of the largest and smallest things in the universe, roughly halfway between the vast scale of galaxies and the tiny world of atoms. And he points to other factors as well.
We're made of the rarest stuff in the universe, heavy elements, the kind of atoms that are only created deep inside stars. And we live at the center of the time of our planetary system. The Earth and the Sun were born about 4.5 billion years ago, and about 5 billion years in the future, the Sun is going to profoundly change. It will turn into a red giant star, and it may burn Earth to a crisp. So in very interesting ways, we live at the center of time, at the center of size scales, and the human mind is the most complex thing that we have discovered in the entire universe, and that makes us pretty special.
Joel Primack wants to tell a new creation story, grounded in science, but it's a particular way of thinking about science that creates space for meaning and purpose, two words we more often associate with religion. George Valiant is also trying to formulate a science-based spirituality, but he's looking at the latest brain science. Valiant is a psychiatrist at Harvard and author of the book Spiritual Evolution, A Scientific Defense of Faith. He believes positive emotions like joy, love, and gratitude are what shape our basic sense of spirituality. He says these feelings are generated by our brain's limbic system, and they're deeply felt emotions, not abstract ideas coming from the cortex, the more analytical part of the brain. Valiant is out to rescue spirituality from religious dogma, but he's also challenging the way scientists usually talk about faith.
The trouble with science is it takes us back up into the cortex, and I think that where meaning comes from is fostering and bringing positive emotions into consciousness so that it isn't science I'm pushing as much as to say if you can pull up into awareness joy, forgiveness, love, and compassion, your life is going to have a whole lot of meaning.
In the pantheon of sacred science, one of the luminaries is Jane Goodall, the famous primatologist who spent decades observing chimpanzees in Tanzania. She's often wondered what the study of chimps can reveal about our hominid ancestors millions of years ago, and perhaps even about the origins of religion. Goodall is also the rare scientist who talks openly about her own mystical experiences.
One moment was very, very special, and that was when I was sitting in the forest with David Greybeard. And I picked up a fruit and held it out to him, and he turned his head away, and I put my hand closer. And he turned, looking directly into my eyes, he reached out, took the fruit, dropped it, he really didn't want it. And then he very gently squeezed my hand, which is how chimpanzees reassure each other. And so in that moment, we communicated in a way that seems to predate words. Perhaps in a way that was used by our own common ancestor millions of years ago. And it was an extraordinary feeling. It was bridging these two worlds.
Sounds like you're very drawn to this whole idea of somehow knowing the world without language, without words.
I am fascinated by it. I always have been. I mean, we think with words. And when we don't think with words, I think we come close to what mystics might describe as a mystical experience, because I don't think that words would come into that.
Did you have experiences like that at Gombe? I mean, what we would call mystical experiences?
Yeah, sometimes. One was just when I'd been following a little group of chimpanzees and I was very wet, and they climbed in the evening up into this tree which had new shoots of beautiful lime green, and the sun behind them was making them shine, and the trunks of the trees were still wet, and the chimpanzees' coats were black ebony shot with little gleams of chestnut, and the smell of ripe figs was strong in the air. And then this beautiful male bushbuck appeared with his coat dark with the rain, and it seemed I could hear the insects really loud and clear, and it was just incredibly vivid beingness and being at one with that beautiful world.
It's one thing to say there's something sacred about the natural world, and quite another to try to create a new science-based religion with no transcendent God. But that's exactly what Stuart Kaufman aims to do. Kaufman's a biologist, one of the gurus of complexity theory, and a recipient of a MacArthur Genius Award. In his book Reinventing the Sacred, he criticizes the reductionist paradigm of modern science, saying it's left us flailing in a sea of meaninglessness. He claims that reductionism simply can't explain the inherent unpredictability of biology or human culture. But what's most audacious is Kaufman's attempt to redefine the word God for non-believers. So what is Kaufman's God? The ceaseless creativity of nature itself.
God is the most powerful symbol humanity has created. We've been worshiping God or gods at least since the sacred Earth Mother 10,000 years ago in Europe. Whether it's the creator, transcendent God of the Abrahamic tradition or other notions of God, God carries with it a sense of awe, reverence, wonder that no other symbol carries. Now we have our choice. Is it more astonishing to believe that a creator God created everything that has come to exist, the planets, the galaxies, chemistry, life, consciousness, agency, in 6 days? Or is it equally or even more astonishing and awesome to believe what is almost certainly the truth, namely that all of this came to be all on its own?
Okay, you can say all that, but you don't have to talk about God. And yet you, for some reason, want to invoke...
I want to invoke God.
Yeah, yes. Why?
First of all, we don't have to. I do not want to invoke a transcendent God. I do believe in this new scientific worldview. I think that even without using the God word, if you feel yourself in this new scientific worldview, it changes your stance towards it from one of the secular humanists' lack of spirituality to a kind of sense of awed wonder that was missing 50 years ago and is missing in the secular world largely that we live in, which is a consumerist, materialist society, where being spiritual is, if not frowned upon, it's something that you do in the privacy of, you know, your own mind. Mm-hmm. You don't talk about it openly because there's something questionable and flaky about it for those of us who don't believe in God.
That's biologist Stuart Kaufman. We also heard from Jane Goodall, George Valiant, Joel Primack, Ursula Goodenough, and E.O. Wilson, all practitioners in one way or another of what you might call sacred science.
Steve Paulson prepared that report on science and the sacred. Coming up, the healing powers of trees and the deep connection between physics and the contemplative life. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Can Science Be Sacred? Is part of our special series, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Our series, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, is supported by grants from the John Templeton Foundation, supporting science, investing in the big questions, by Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science, and by the Neuer Foundation, exploring meaning and commonality of human experience.
Diana Beresford Kroger calls herself a renegade scientist. She's a botanist, a medical biochemist, and an expert on the healing properties of trees. She's also an avid gardener. On her 160-acre property in Ontario, Canada, she's planted more than 100 different species of trees. Some of them, she believes, contain cures for cancer and other illnesses. In a new essay collection called The Global Forest, Beresford Kroger writes that trees are sacred. She told Anne Strainchamps that the lives of trees and humans are interrelated all the way down to the most basic molecular level.
Well, they are sister molecules working together, as a matter of fact. They're both designed by the genome. In one case, in the case of you and I, they're designed by our own genetic code. And in the case of the tree, all trees, they're designed by the tree itself. For us, it's the hemoglobin. For you and I, the hemoglobin is an important oxygen transporter into our blood system, and in fact that keeps us alive. It is really the only thing that keeps us alive. If you're a tree, the tree does the very opposite with the same type of molecule, the same design of molecule. What the tree does is it takes chlorophyll, which is sequestering carbon dioxide out of the air in the presence of water, some water, and also in the presence of sunlight, photonic energy from sunlight, and lo and behold, it makes oxygen, and we little creatures creep around and breathe that oxygen. So the tree can survive without us, which makes it more clever, because we cannot survive without the tree.
You know, North America was once covered in trees, and there are really very few stands of virgin forest left on this continent, but we do still have a lot of those native trees. In your book, you tell some marvelous little-known facts about, well, for one thing, the medicinal properties of trees. For example, we were talking about those native species of trees in North America. The black walnut is one of them.
Yes.
Which turns out to have some extraordinary medicinal aspects.
Well, really, the black walnut for America is probably your most extraordinary heritage tree. In the black walnut itself, if you have a child and you bring a child for a walk when they're producing the green fruit, and that would be in August for everybody in North America, get the child to hold the green fruit and get play with it for a little while. It gives them a protection to childhood leukemia.
And if you that's extraordinary.
Yeah, and it's called ellagic acid. Ellagic acid goes into the sweat glands of the child and helps the child to protect them against leukemia for about a year. And for women, all of us, because of the massive use of pesticides in the world, day after day after day after day, we're susceptible because it breaks down beta oxidation. This pesticide goes into our breast, stays in our breast, blocks beta oxidation, and we are prone to breast cancer. So what we do is we go to the black walnut, pick a couple of leaves and crunch the leaves in our hands. This is at the end of August and the beginning of September, when the compounds called ellagic acid again are highest in the tree itself. And juglone is high again as a serenading kind of complex in it. And rub the inside of your arm with the leaf, and that will give you some protection to breast cancer.
What happened to America's native black walnut forests?
Oh, we've only got 60 acres left. and it is in the central part of America. The trees were cut down. The trees are extremely valuable. And now, any of your listeners out there, if any of you want to become instant millionaires, you can go out and grow and plant black walnuts. One well-grown black walnut will outpace any mutual funds. You can snub your nose at Wall Street, and you have got the money for your grandchild for their university education, because it can be sold at auction for $60,000, because there is not enough black walnut wood left in the world.
You know, it strikes me that what you've discovered from science about trees is simply bearing out what so many ancient mystical legends have told us about trees.
Yeah.
You're a scientist with a degree in medical biochemistry and botany.
God knows what, yeah.
But, you know, you also have whole chapters on magical trees and mystical forests.
Yeah.
Why is it important to see trees in both ways, using both sets of language?
You have to have an open mind. I mean, you can't have a closed mind in science. You can't go around with your eyes closed and a pair of blinkers on you. And when I was a child in Ireland, my whole family was killed off. So by the time I was 11, I was an orphan. I'm a mongrel. I'm an aristocratic mongrel, and I come from a very, very, very ancient family. That's a 5th century family in Ireland. And I was the last child of that family. And all of the old 80 and 90 year olds took me under their wing under the Brehon laws. But in the old style of the Druids, they took me under their care and they taught me all kinds of things of the Druidic times, meditation, love, nature, cures, all kinds of extraordinary things. So I would be armed, they told me, for the modern world, for the new world that I was to face. And they put on my head that I would be the last voice of the ancient Gaelic world. And indeed, some of the Druids were right.
So as the last living descendant of an ancient Druidic tradition, is there particular tree wisdom that you feel compelled to transmit to the rest of us?
Yes. Don't cut them down. Don't cut the trees down. If you cut the trees down, you kill yourself. It's really that simple. Easter Island is an example. All of the trees were cut in Easter Island and the fish went too after that and everybody died. I mean, we've got to stop this thing called greed.
You have a passage, sort of sounds fictional in the book, but it makes me think you've had this experience of standing in a forest grove, praying and leaning toward trees and opening your eyes and realizing that the trees were leaning towards you.
Yes, that did happen. The trees were listening to me as I was praying in Gaelic. The prayers of Gaelic are na haratha nav, these Gaelic words into the air. I was praying just in my waiting time to focus my mind for doing other things. And I found that the trees were leaning to me as I was leaning to God. And then I realized we were all leaning to the same thing and that all God was unity. This profound feeling of unity, of the song of the land calling to me. It was really quite an experience.
I'm interested that you call it the song of the land, because as someone who works in radio, I was especially fascinated by your chapter on trees and sound.
We're deaf and dumb, really. I mean, we are so arrogant. We assume that because we don't hear in the region of 1 to 400 hertz, that nobody else hears this. Of course they do. Dogs do, and little children do, and cats do, and monkeys apparently do. All large things produce, well, like I say, a song of the universe. The elephants do. They produce from 0 to 400 again in messages of danger from one elephant to another, even though they're 10 miles apart. But the trees do the same thing. They're very large creatures, and they produce these soft, long waves of energy that actually can be measured. And the birds are very sensitive to this, and the birds come and march to the trees that they want to march to and nest and come back to the same tree every time. But now I want you to think about something. The shape of the human body, we're shaped like a viola or a big cello. We have a neck, we have the chest, which is mostly an empty cavity, and we have our diaphragm. We are receptors. And the hearing from trees is like the feeling of a symphony. When you go into this marvelous symphony
and you hear music overcomes you, it floods you, it goes through you. You are the music, and you get this extraordinary feeling in your chest. And in Gaelic, in the old Gaelic world, that is called, you say, Tá an tacht a gam. I have the feeling of a squeezing in the chest, and that is the feeling of the trees.
Diana Beresford Groger is a horticulturalist with degrees in botany and medical biochemistry. Her bio plan for North America would reforest the continent with trees planted for their medicinal, environmental, and nutritional properties. She's the author of Arboretum America and The Global Forest. Anne Strainsham spoke with her. Arthur Zients is a physicist at Amherst College. His research deals with the experimental foundations of quantum mechanics. He also has a long-standing meditative practice, and for decades he's explored the connection between science and the sacred. In fact, he's talked on various occasions with the Dalai Lama about physics and contemplative life. Zients says the greatest scientists often have a philosophical and even spiritual understanding of reality.
Einstein repeatedly spoke about what he called a religious feeling that he had as he looked into the universe, as he applied himself to his science, as he played his piano even. There was a sense of the sublime, of the miraculous. He called it Spinoza's God, which was a kind of God of geometry, mathematics, wonder. But he rejected any notion of a personal God. And I think that for many scientists, if there is an aspect to the universe and to the work they do, it could be called the sacred. It's in the sense that Einstein spoke about it.
It's clear listening to you that you have found a way to integrate your sense of science with your sense of the sacred. Was that always true?
You know, 40 years ago when I was 20, this was a kind of torment for me, I guess I'd say. You know, I'd abandoned conventional religious life. I'd committed myself to study of physics. But the more I studied the physics as it was given in the textbooks and in the research journals, the more distant I felt from the core dimensions of my life, the spiritual dimensions of my life. And I'd say one of the keys to the change in that relationship was the beginnings of a meditative practice. You could say exploration of the mind, which to me has many of the same disciplined elements that science has. The commitment to experience. This is not fantasy. It's a way of exploring step by step, experientially, who we are, and bringing our thought, our careful analysis to that in ways that can be productive.
Are you saying that you see in meditation a kind of science of spirituality? Are you applying the scientific method to a search for meaning?
Yes. I think you put it very succinctly. There's nothing to keep us from turning that lens of our own understanding within and exploring the nature of the mind directly, using also the kind of care, rational thought, and so forth, that we're accustomed to bringing to the outer domains.
I want to explore the ways in which you see these two streams diverging and potentially joining. And I think maybe one way is to go back and ask you why it was that at the age of 20 you had abandoned conventional religion. Was it studying science? Was it studying physics that drove you away initially from spirituality?
Well, I was raised in a relatively conventional Catholic household. I felt that there's a certain understanding of the sacraments that's had in Catholicism. Namely, it doesn't matter who the priest is, what their moral stature is, what their intelligence is. I mean, it's just a person up there who's performing a kind of ritual which transforms wine and bread into the blood and body of Christ. It doesn't matter whether you're presenting yourself in a way which is flattering or unflattering. And in many cases, the priests that I met, I didn't have a lot of respect for. That felt somehow inappropriate, that there should be a depth of spiritual striving at least. And I didn't sense that. I sensed a kind of resignation or ineffectiveness somehow within that priesthood. So I turned away from that. What I was looking for was a spirituality that was ardent and more striving, I'd say. And then I didn't find it until I took up the practices associated with that striving, namely extended meditation and contemplation. Later on, I began to realize that this practice that I was undertaking seemed to be in alignment with the kinds of experiments, if you will, that I was doing in the laboratory. In other words, they both are domains of experience, domains of empirical results, one the interior of my mind and the other the exterior of my laboratory.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it? You talked earlier about Einstein's belief in what he called Spinoza's God. It seems to me, I may be wrong, that in an earlier time there was an easier connection between science and the sacred, that someone like Einstein could be attracted to Spinoza's God while clearly being a great scientist. And he wasn't alone in this, was he?
You know, most of the early great scientists, whether it's Max Planck, Niels Bohr, Erwin Schrödinger, Heisenberg, Einstein, these were all extraordinarily well-educated human beings, and so they had an inherently philosophical orientation towards that which they were studying, discovering, bringing into the world. They weren't technicians, if you will. They were thoughtful, reflective, you could even say contemplative in their approach to the mysteries they were unearthing. And in a very short period of time, you know, miraculous things were being brought into the world. And so when they went off walking together, which they often did, or sailing on the seas of Germany and Austria and the like, they had the most extraordinary conversations. Heisenberg documents them, and they are ruminating on the implications of what they're doing constantly because they realize it's a whole new universe now. Space and time have been changed. The fundamental laws of the micro world have been discovered and found to be quite different than anything that classical physics had presented. What in the world could this mean, and mean in the largest possible sense about our own nature, how we know the world, and so on? So these are the most powerful existential issues that we confront. Now, that brought them, you could say, into the domain of the sacred, but most of them shied away from and even were rather clear about the fact that this did not mean that they adopted a conventional religious life or attitude. They stayed on this side of that divide.
Well, because there are a lot of things to ask you about that, but this thing that strikes me right away, given the subject that we're discussing, can science be sacred, is that so few of your colleagues these days seem to be talking about these things. I mean, Stephen Hawking has just written a book arguing that science is all you need, that science itself can explain the origins of the universe. And he says that philosophy is dead because it hasn't kept up with developments in modern science. What's going on? Why would a scientist of Hawking's stature want to say that?
Well, there's a kind of interesting way in which I agree with Hawking. So in one sense, it should be obvious that I'm completely coming at this whole question from another standpoint, from another angle. At the same time, I think he's right. Simone Weil had this great line where she says, "The absence of God is the most marvelous testimony of perfect love." One of the favorite lines of mine, the absence of God. In some sense, the greatest gift that the sacred can offer us is its absence. If God were everywhere present, then there would be no question about belief in God, right? It'd be like, basically like believing in chairs and tables. But the absence of God poses a question. Is there or isn't there? Is there the sacred or is there not? Is it something we can come to know or not? In other words, we're left free. And I think that gift of freedom is one of the most important and significant aspects of our lives. Now, what that means is God is plausibly deniable, you know, is in a position where it's unclear whether there is a God or isn't a God. So Stephen Hawking can say, "I don't think there is one." And he can be arguing from a clear and adequate understanding of science. On the other hand, I think if one engages the question more fully, becomes more reflective, more contemplative, explores the inner life, one begins to develop a sense that, no, this world, both the outer world of science, but also the inner world of contemplative experience, demands in the end that we acknowledge the existence of something beyond ourselves, which we might call the sacred. So I think he rightly points to the fact that God is not necessary for a physical universe. But you can ask, you know, is he necessary for an inner or moral universe that we discover within? And in my experience is to an objective, open-minded awareness, yes.
That's Arthur Zients, a physicist at Amherst College. He's been one of the organizers of the Mind and Life Dialogues between scientists and the Dalai Lama.
Every so often, a wildlife biologist will pull back the cloak of science and reveal something highly personal. It's the case with Baruti Galdikas, the world's best-known orangutan expert. One of Louis Leakey's protégés, she was the first person to do a long-term field study in Borneo. Galdikas says her encounters with wild orangutans have, at times, felt otherworldly, especially when she has stared into their eyes and they've looked back at her.
It's almost like finding God. It's a powerful moment of transcendence. It's suddenly you realize that you're not alone in the universe. And those moments were very, very powerful. And of course, they came from the fact that there was total, absolutely total isolation. And they came out of the fact that there was total acceptance on the part of the orangutans, and possibly on my part as well, of the situation. And those moments had the intensity of a religious experience. The setting does reflect, you know, the kind of setting that we have in Gothic cathedrals or in mosques. There's sort of these beams of light, you know, that shoot from the sky, and there's a sort of a hush and a quiet. And I think that what churches try to do is they try to duplicate, you know, the ancient forest from which we came. And so, like, when you go into the forest, it's like going into a church, but not into a church created by humans, into the original church, into the original, you know, Garden of Eden, which was our home, which is where we became human. These kinds of experiences help explain why people frequently become almost addicted to helping certain species or become addicted to nature. It's because they find something there that they can find no place else.
That's Baruti Galdikas of the Orangutan Foundation International. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Can Science Be Sacred? Is part of our special series, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Our series, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, is supported by grants from the John Templeton Foundation, supporting science, investing in the big questions, by Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science, and by the Noor Foundation, exploring meaning and commonality of human experience.
On some mornings, I step outside before pulling on any socks or sliding my feet into their shoes. The soil presses up against my bare feet and shapes itself to them. The clumped grasses massage and wake up my souls.
David Abram, reading from his book Becoming Animal, An Earthly Cosmology.
My steps slow down further. Flat rocks and rough rocks, needles cast off by the pines, grit that clings between the toes as they flex against the land. My feet are like ears listening downward. Try this. When the mood strikes you, step out upon the solid earth without the intermediary of a rubber or leather sole. Notice the way your feet, pressing against the coarse ground, are also being met by that ground. Watch how spontaneously your feet relax their pace in order to respect this odd otherness, an old ancestral affinity between the human foot and the solid ground is replenished by the simple act of stepping outside without shoes.
An excerpt from David Abram's book, Becoming Animal. Abram is an environmental philosopher. You might call him an animist because he finds a living presence, not just in people or even animals, but also in rocks, wind, even houses. Now, I should add, there's nothing supernatural about what Abram's talking about. He's not invoking elves or nature spirits.
but he does think nature's alive in ways we barely notice. Steve Paulson talked with Abram about what it means to become animal.
Do you think many of us have lost the ability to experience the world simply through our senses, not just in our mind?
I do. When we think today, it tends to be a fairly abstract cogitation that unfolds entirely in our skull and has very little to do with stones, buildings, animals, the wind, the clouds overhead.
Let me follow up on that because, I mean, you are invoking, it seems to me, a really radical rethinking of how we see the world. I mean, an animist view that perhaps was the way most of our ancestors thought for many generations, but certainly is hardly experienced anymore. And obviously, there are lots of skeptics about this way of thinking. In fact, at one point you write, confronted with animistic styles of discourse, most of us moderns can only imagine it as a sort of childlike ignorance, a credulous projection of human-like feelings onto mountains and rivers, which surely amounts to madness for any adult soul. Rocks alive? Yeah, right. Are you talking about this in a metaphorical sense or something more?
I think there is something more than a metaphor here. It cannot be sheer coincidence that virtually every indigenous oral culture that we still know of all share in common this animistic propensity to think of the surrounding material world as something that is alive through and through. It's quite clear that this was the style of perception common to our own indigenous ancestors.
But a lot of people would say that was people believed that way, still do in some cultures, because they lacked a certain scientific understanding. As you put it in your book, you say that a lot of intellectuals in particular kind of write off this way of thinking as overly romantic and backward-looking nostalgia.
Well, I think they're dead wrong. When we speak of cultures as diverse as the Koyukon people of Alaska or the Hopi and the Navajo or Diné people of the Southwest, here where I'm speaking to you, or the Guarani or the Kayapo people of the Amazon basin, we're speaking of cultures that are traditionally oral cultures, that is to say, cultures that have developed and thrived for many, many generations, century after century, without a formal system of writing.
And that's an important point for you. You think that something changes once a culture develops the written word, once a culture has an alphabet.
Indeed. Well, once a culture has a formal writing system of any sort, once language is written on the page, then the page becomes the primary mnemonic or memory trigger for remembering stories. Writing is a kind of magic. That is to say, it has a potency, a power to affect and influence our senses that cannot be explained by a purely rational take on things. As soon as we glance at a printed word, we hear it speak. We see what it says instantly. It speaks to us. That's a kind of magic.
And you make the point that there were profound philosophical and spiritual implications to the power of the written word. I mean, you say that monotheism could only rise in a culture with an alphabet because only that way could we develop an understanding of God entirely outside the physical world.
I think everything that we now conventionally call Western civilization might more precisely be spoken of as alphabetized civilization. And the three peoples of the book, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, the monotheistic religions are very much informed and, I believe, made possible by this new technology or magic that captures, in a sense, the human voice, tracing it out on the scroll or on the page, a voice that seemed to live outside of time entirely, hence outside of the visible, audible, sensorial terrain.
Now, you've used the word magic a number of times, both when you're talking about the power of words, of the written word, as well as the way indigenous people see the world. And it's worth pointing out that you are a magician, conjurer, who challenges the way we perceive the world. How has this influenced your thinking?
My first profession was that of a sleight-of-hand magician. I performed in clubs and venues throughout the United States. At a certain point, I ventured to travel as an itinerant magician into Southeast Asia, into more remote village areas within Sri Lanka, within Indonesia, within the high mountains of Nepal.
So what would you do? Just start performing some tricks as you were walking down a village road?
No. Well, at first, I began in that way when I stepped into the less developed world. But I quickly discovered that this was not helpful because huge crowds would gather around me. And so I was unable to meet the traditional magicians that I was interested in finding and learning from.
By traditional magicians, you're talking about the shamans.
I'm talking about those folks we now tend to call shamans, though that's a term that derives from a few cultures in northern Siberia. I tend to feel that the word shaman has been overused and sort of sold down the river, become over-commercialized. And so I use the term magician, traditional magicians, to speak of these folks who are often the healers, the primary healers in their region.
Let's talk about this in a more concrete sense, because you have a remarkable story about an experience you had in the Himalayas, in the mountains of Nepal. You spent some time with, sounds like a very powerful traditional magician you call Sonam. Can you tell me about him? What attracted you to him?
It was apparent from some of the rumors that had reached my ears that this was an uncommonly gifted and skilled magician or shaman. There, the term is Dzongkri. He was one of probably the most powerful Dzongkri I encountered in my travels in that part of the world. But what was most startling to me when I met him was how my own bodily organism began to feel very strange, even as I was just approaching the area where he lived. When I finally met Sonam, and my translator, my Sherpa translator, was so unnerved by meeting him that he insisted that he could not translate for me. And
He thought there was some demonic force there.
I don't know if he felt it as a demonic force, but for his culture, there is a sense that such magicians need to be respected and not come too close to, not intruded upon, because there's something quite dangerous about this kind of power. But when I met this man, what struck me was that I was coming into the presence of a human animal.
You tell a remarkable story after you had gotten to know him and you were working with him. There was one time when you and he were hiking back up a mountain trail and he was a bit ahead of you and he seemed to turn into a bird, into a raven. Can you describe that experience?
We were hiking back along a very narrow trail that wound along the side of a very precipitous mountain slope. And at one point in the trail, he rounded a bend up in front, and I couldn't see him for a stretch. As I approached that same bend, I heard the croak of a raven. And then as I came around the bend, I saw this raven perched on a large boulder jutting out to the left of the trail above the river gorge beneath. And this raven was squawking a couple times as it looked at me and blinked and squawked again. And then the raven leapt or hopped off the rock down onto the trail. And as it did so, it seemed first to be flying straight into my face, and my hands flew up as if to protect me. But then it landed on the trail, except the sound was too loud for it to be just the raven landing on the trail. And as I blinked, this small raven turned out to be a person. it was Sonam himself, but he was standing much farther down the trail than I had thought the raven. I thought the raven was really a few feet from me, but it was more 25 feet down the trail. Was Sonam now standing in the trail, looking much smaller than he would have if he was just, 8 or 10 feet away. But I was stunned. And he took off down in front of me again, and I thought, I must have just imagined this. But then he turned, and he cocked his head, looking at me, and he squawked a perfect series of raven's caws. And I realized that I had just witnessed a transformation of a human into a bird and back again.
You write about how he then gave you various exercises to do to essentially experience the world like a raven. I mean, very rigorous exercises to almost call up a raven to come and visit you and then stare at a certain part of a raven. And then eventually you seem to fly like a raven.
I was watching a raven very, very intently and placing my focus not just on the back of its neck, but sinking the focus of my eyes into its body and trying to bring my other senses, my tactile and visceral senses, to bear over there where my eyes were focused in the body of this other bird, so that when the bird hopped and then spread its wings and took off, I quite unexpectedly found myself aloft and soaring over the river gorge with this bird. Again, it was completely unexpected, but it was an experience that dramatically changed my life and my sense of what the human body is capable of and what our senses and human perception is capable of.
David Abram is a cultural ecologist and environmental philosopher. He talked with Steve Paulson about his book, Becoming Animal, An Earthly Cosmology. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Can Science Be Sacred? Is part of our special series, Science and the Search for Meaning, 5 Questions, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio. Original theme music for the series was written by Steve Mullen at Walk West Productions. For more information on this series and to find additional material about the topics we've explored, please go to our website at ttbook.org/scienceandmeaning. And special thanks to two of our sponsors for Science and the Search for Meaning, the John Templeton Foundation, supporting science, investing in the big questions, and Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science.
PRI, Public Radio International.